Good evening. This is Peter Helland with Dr. E. Michael Jones. I think, Mike, it's been quite a while since you've been back on. A lot has happened. I think we're choosing to point out that you finished a book in between the last time. And it has many pages, and if I could jump into the theme of the book and then see where it corresponds to some of the themes of the show. I think we quoted from the book of Titus a lot, and I think that there's a lot of themes in Scripture. Obviously, you're given the position kind of resourcing the Catholic Church somewhat, authors and that, to track this book, The History of Capitalism. But let's look at these scriptures here, and I don't know if they'd be helpful, if they'd be of help to help us to understand how this book would be important to Christians. In Titus it says, for there are many, in chapter 1, for there are many unruly, vain talkers and deceivers, especially they of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole houses, teaching things which they ought not, for filthy lucre's sake. Goes on and says, wherefore rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men that turn from the truth. And then it closes in that chapter and says, they profess that they know God, but in works they deny him. I'm kind of asking you to see if, as you talk about this book, is there something that your book does address that's relevant to a Christian as they read the scriptures and as they...
Well, if you're talking about that particular passage, this book it's a history of capitalism, but it's also a sequel to my book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit.
Right, and you said at one time it's the flip side of the same coin.
It's the flip side of that coin. So the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, to recapitulate, talks about the Jewish revolutionary and how that began with the Jews confronting their Messiah. The Messiah comes to save the lost children of the house of Israel, and they have to make up their mind whether they're going to accept Jesus Christ or reject him. So the Jews who accept him became known as the Catholic Church. These are the people that the direct line of history from Abraham to Moses to Jesus Christ to the church. That's the direct line of history, which makes it confusing because we still have Jews around, and the Jews are the people who rejected Jesus Christ. And we've talked about this before on your program. And when the Jews rejected Jesus Christ, they became revolutionaries because they rejected not only Christ, but Christ as the Logos, which is to say reason or order, the order of the universe as a manifestation of God's mind, is what they rejected. Well, when you do that, you're a revolutionary. And so since that time, they've become this permanent body. I think this is what St. Paul is adverting to there. This permanent revolutionary body that's always spreading kind of dissenting ideas, subverting the morals of the Christian population, coming up with crazy theories that everybody thinks are great for about 5 years, and then suddenly everybody realizes they're stupid. That's the type of thing we're talking about.
A lot of people are revolutionaries, but what's unique about the Jewish revolutionary spirit is that the one thing that holds them together is their rejection of Christ.
Right.
Whereas the Hell's Angels don't define themselves by the common denominator is that they reject Christ. Because if a Jew does accept Christ, then they're kicked out of the synagogue. I mean, they're no longer considered a Jew.
Right.
Where they could become a Buddhist or an atheist.
Right. Yes.
So that makes them...
But I think what you see is, yes, there are all kinds of revolutionary groups out there, but I think what you see over the course of history, and that's what I pointed out in my book, is that these revolutionary groups invariably tend to take on Jewish characteristics. So the prime example from an American perspective would be the Puritans, okay, who were revolutionaries in England, decapitated the king, came over here, and then created a kind of revolutionary society over here based on mammon, devoting themselves to mammon. This is what Karl Marx said in Zur Judenfrage, which led to a revolution in this country. The Yankees were the revolutionary ferment, and then that led to a civil war and another revolution.
But they also had a theology that elevated the Jews. In other words, the Puritan hope was that Christ would come back at the same time, corresponding to a time period where the Jews would be converted back to their land, and converted. And their hope was fully set on a revival that would occur at this time. And a lot of people think, Cotton Mather himself said that's a crazy idea, but
even though his father articulated that crazy idea. So, yeah, it's still around. We still have Christians with crazy Jewish ideas, you know, the Christian Zionists, the dispensationalists. They're still around, big supporters of Israel. But what I'm saying is that this characteristic here, the Jewish revolutionary spirit becomes a model for Christians as well. And I think that to take it all the way up to date, I don't want to beat this horse to death here, but to take one of the prime victims in the United States has been the black population, who were turned into Jewish revolutionaries by groups like the NAACP, beginning in, 1915, sometime around, in the aftermath of the Leo Frank case. For 70 years, the Jews tried to turn the black people into the avant-garde of the revolution in the United States, and they finally succeeded, but only in the South, where the civil rights movement became that revolution, where they overthrew the social order. So it's still there. The problem we have in places like Ferguson, for example, is that this group, black people, have internalized these Jewish ideas. They consider they act like revolutionaries, even though they don't know what that means. You know, they have this perennial chip on their shoulder. You know what I mean? They're in rebellion against Logos when it comes to the sexual order, sexual morality. 80% of black people are born out of wedlock now as a result of this revolutionary chaos that got introduced into their lives by the Jews who ran the civil rights movement and the NAACP and all those revolutionary organizations. So it's still with us. When they create a Frankenstein monster, you have to kill the monster. That's the story of Frankenstein. And so in 1969, the FBI moved against the Black Panthers in Chicago and killed them all, or with the help of the Chicago police, because they had gotten uppity. Okay, you know, they were walking around with guns, black leather jackets, and so on and so forth. The same thing is happening now in American foreign policy. ISIL, these beheaders, the liver eaters, the Takfiri in Iraq now, are another Frankenstein monster created as a proxy warrior caste to overthrow a regime they don't like. So just as the black people in Chicago were turned on the Catholics to drive them out of their neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago, so ISIL was created to drive Assad from power in Syria. And ISIL, they're another Frankenstein. They're out of control now. Everybody knows they're out of control. They're cutting people's heads off. I mean, this is, they're monsters. There's no exaggeration to call these people monsters. But they were created by the United States in the same way. So that being said, that's that side of the story. That's the revolutionary side of the story. But there's another side of the story. And that's told by, in many ways, one of these Jewish revolutionaries, Karl Marx, who wasn't a Jew. I mean, his father had converted to Christianity, but he was the grandson of a rabbi from Germany, from Trier. Came from an ancient line of rabbis and imbibed the Jewish revolutionary spirit and gave it a new form known as communism. And he understood the other side of the coin very well, because he said in his essay called On the Jewish Question, or Zur Judenfrage, he said the Jewish God is money. Jewish God is money.
Well, the South said that about all Northerners, basically.
Well, that's because there is one of the most potent gods out there is money, or mammon, as we say in the Bible. So what you see here are basically two parallel tracks. And so if I can, how can I symbolize this, this relationship? Balzac is walking through the streets of Paris in the 1830s, and there he sees Heinrich Heine and Jacob or James Rothschild walking arm in arm through the streets of Paris. Now, from a Marxian perspective, if you're going to say that a revolution is based on class conflict, this makes no sense whatsoever. The richest man in Europe walking arm in arm with the premier Jewish revolutionary from Germany. That doesn't make any sense from a Marxian point of view, but it does make sense from an ethnic point of view, because they're both Jews. And they both sense this. What do they have in common? They have this sense of hatred toward Christian culture. And they're both working. So what you find after a while is that both capitalism and communism are both working to destroy Christian culture wherever they find it. So a later manifestation of the same thing would be Jacob Schiff and Trotsky. Jacob Schiff, one of the richest Jews in New York City, and Trotsky, one of the most famous Jewish revolutionaries, collaborate. Schiff gives Trotsky money. Trotsky rents a ship and got all these revolutionaries. They sail to Russia. Why are they going to attack Russia? Well, because it's the only Christian country left in Europe. So you take the two books together, and so the Jewish revolutionary spirit is about Heine and Trotsky. And Baron Metal is about the Rothschild family, for example.
And Schiff.
And Schiff and Lloyd Blankfein. And Lloyd Blankfein, to give you a recent example, is chairman of Goldman Sachs, which is a Jewish firm. And he supports gay marriage. So once again, you have this Jewish penchant here of the rich supporting the revolution. And as a result, destroying the social order. But we don't want to just destroy the social order. What they want to do is create a new social order, a Jewish social order in which the Jews are in control. And the main way the Jew stays in control is through usury.
And just Goldman Sachs, I was at the Heritage Foundation meeting in Atlanta, and a lot of people were really wanting Ted Cruz to be their top choice for president. But they also said, if you're going to vet a politician, you need to find out the spouse and who the spouse works for. And I brought up, well, Ted Cruz's wife is a vice president for Goldman Sachs.
And what did the Heritage people say to that? Next question.
Right, because the spouse and who she works for, they were saying, can determine a lot about what that politician is going to
do. Sure. We could go down that road as well. But what I'm trying to say here is that we're dealing with two fundamentally different views of the economy, because we're dealing with two fundamentally different views of human nature, of man. And the two fundamentally different views are epitomized by the two alternatives for economies throughout the world. It's not capitalism versus communism. It's labor versus usury.
Now, when you say the word economy, do you need to define how you define the word economy?
The economy is the all of the people in a nation. Let's define it the way Pesch would, as the function of a nation state. The people engaging in exchange of goods and services in the nation. All of those people taken together make up the economy of the nation. All those people working, exchanging, making deals, and so on and so forth for the throughout the nation.
Okay.
The combination of all of those interactions is called the economy.
Okay. And so, like, for example, you were talking about the living wage.
So basically, as I said, we have two choices in this world. And the two choices are to base the economy on labor or to base it on usury. And so the ancient world, to begin with, was based on slavery. Aristotle could not conceive of a world without slavery. He could not conceive of a philosopher without slavery, doing a slave doing all the manual labor that would allow him the leisure to philosophize.
Well, he may be correct. I mean, we call people that have these jobs out here, we say they're not slaves, but
we are heading, as you're correct in saying, we are heading back to the slavery of the Roman Empire. So slavery was one aspect of the Roman Empire. The other aspect is usury. And these two things go hand in hand because usury creates slavery. And the magic formula that does this is known as compound interest. And compound interest is such a magical thing. They went to ask Einstein, if you had to come up with one idea, what do you think is the most brilliant idea you could come up with? And he said compound interest. Because if you're on the right side of compound interest, in other words, if you are a creditor, the money just pours into your pocket and you don't have to do anything. If you're on the wrong side of compound interest, which is to say if you're a debtor, well, then you can do whatever you want and you're still falling. You're going to fall behind because nothing in this world can keep up with the inexorable nature of compound interest. So you put this together in an empire like the Roman Empire, which basically acquired wealth from plunder, wealth in the form of gold, plundering other countries, bringing the gold back to Rome. That gold ended up into the hands of wealthy people who would then lend it out at interest. And as a result, everyone in the Roman Empire, the overwhelming majority, started to fall into debt slavery. And so by the end of the Roman Empire, you had the independent Roman farmer who was the backbone of the Roman army during the Republic had been forced to the wall because he could not pay off the mortgage on his farm into becoming a slave on a latifundia, which is like the factory farm of its era. Now, that would have stayed that way probably forever, except that something happened at the time of the Roman Empire, namely the arrival of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And when he arrived, he gave new dignity to the human being because of the incarnation. God became man. And so because of the incarnation, human beings had a new dignity. And because human beings had a new dignity, their activity had a new dignity. And what do we call the activity of human beings? Basically, it's called work. And so as a result, when the Roman Empire collapsed because of debt, because of all of the things that's plaguing this country, because of debt, of foreign wars, of enslavement, of the concentration of wealth, and so on and so forth, the new system that took its place was Christianity, in particular, because of the peculiarities of the time, because of the collapse of civilization. The new system was implemented by Benedictine monks, who created monasteries, which were basically self-sufficient little kingdoms. Not really, can't call it a king. Self-sufficient little farms, whatever you want to call them, where the monks would have land, they took a vow of stability, and they were bound to the land by their vow, and so they would work the land. And the new thing in history at this point is the motto of the Benedictines, which is Ora et Labora, which is pray and work. Now, nobody had said that before. Aristotle couldn't conceive of a world in which men could, in a sense, work with the intellect and work with the body at the same time, which is what the monks did.
Right, the contemplation, our contemplation is what they admired, right, Aristotle?
Yeah.
They didn't think it possible for the working class to.
But you would call those people philosophers, and it was impossible for a worker to be a philosopher.
Well, the Book of Sirach says something like that too, that one who's given to labor can never gain wisdom. I mean, so.
Well, I mean, there's a certain truth to that. I mean, there's a certain truth to that, but it's not an absolute truth, and it changed over time, and it changed because Christianity raised the dignity of labor to something which we could appreciate. So given this fact, now we have a whole new world. And the whole new world begins in Europe. It's kind of rocky beginnings because Europe is being plundered by my ancestors and your ancestors. The Jones family motto was burn and plunder, which meant we always end up with kind of soggy, crappy, burnt stuff. And everybody else's motto was plunder and burn, and they admit that much better. But anyway, the Germanic, the warring barbaric Germanic tribes would come down. They crossed the Danube. They crossed the Rhine. They took over the Roman Empire, and they set up their kingdom. And what's a German love to do? He loves to chase pigs through the forest. So the Lombards set up, and they started chasing pigs through the forest. And it would have remained that way forever, except for the fact that the Benedictines taught them how to engage in agriculture. So you're talking about the Christianization of these barbaric Germanic tribes over this period of time. When things got tough, when the Vikings showed up or the Saracens, you could pull inside the monastery, kind of pull up the gates and wait out the siege and hope they'd go away. And then you come out and you start doing the stuff all over again. Over a certain period of time, this finally took root. The Germans decided to give up chasing pigs through the forest. They decided to raise pigs instead and have farms and so on and so forth. And as a result of this concentration of human labor, what results when you concentrate human labor? Wealth. Wealth started to arise in Europe. And it arose first in the city-states of Italy because they were the most suited for this development at this particular time. So they got involved in manufacturing. And specifically, they got involved in the manufacturing that, in effect, created Europe, which was cloth manufacturing. And the Medici were a family who got involved in cloth manufacturing, so they made wool. And all of the economic developments that we have at the beginning of capitalism came from Italy and the problems that they had with the wool business. So, for example, one of the biggest markets... No, first of all, Italy does not have enough sheep to produce the wool, the cloth they need for their markets.
So their markets were outside of Italy too, right?
It was all of Europe.
Yeah.
It was basically all of Europe. And all of Europe, in a sense, was involved in the production of wool. And it was different kinds of wool depending on where it came from. So because the sheep were different, you know, like the wool in the Danube Valley was tended to be more water resistant. And so it was good for outside garments. And the wool from someplace else was good. It took a really good black color. So the clerics used that a lot and so on and so forth. But Italy was always the top of the market. It was the top end of the market. So they had to get their wool from England. And, okay, that's traveling by ship. Okay, that's annoying to begin with. They had to sell it in northern Europe, in a place like a city like Brugge, which is now in Belgium. And at the beginning, when you had economic exchange, basically money was little pieces of gold or silver. And so what you had to do was carry bags of gold to a place where the buyers and sellers came together. Well, this is always a bad idea because someone can rob you along the way, and that's it. So in order to forestall that, you had to have knights, in other words, bodyguards. But in order to have the bodyguards, you got to pay the bodyguards. And then when they get there, they're always causing trouble. So you create this, like, tournaments, you know, where they joust to keep themselves from killing each other while the people are doing business. Well, it's a bad idea, and it would not sustain the commerce that was needed. So eventually, the Italians in Italy started dealing with their branch firms in Brugge by just saying, okay, I'll ship you this, it will cost this much, and you ship me that, and that will cost that much. And instead of sending gold back and forth, I'll just make an entry here, and you make an entry there. And so this was the beginning of double entry bookkeeping, which obviated the need for carrying pieces of metal around Europe with you. And so it was tending toward paper in that regard. So at this point, you have the beginning of the money economy out of prosperity in Europe. And at this point, because we have a money economy, people need money. That makes sense. The problem is that up until this point, you've got an economy for the average guy, the serf, that is based not on money, but on labor. In other words, you owe the Lord 3 days a week. And if you do that, then your obligation is fulfilled. Well, at this point, the Lord doesn't want 3 days a week. He wants money because he's got to buy things. And so how do you get the money? Where's the money going to come from? Well, you got to borrow it. Well, it's immoral to lend money. So who's going to do it? Well, the Jews are going to do it. And so the Jews would be brought in first to lend money to the prince, and then they could set up small end, low end payday loan operations like Quicken or whatever it is now. And that would allow the Jew would lend you money. And it was a pawn shop, basically. So if you're a farmer, you hock your plow, he gives you money to pay your taxes, and he charges you 43 1/3% interest. Some things never change. We're back to that now. Unfortunately, if you're a farmer and your plow's in the pawn shop, you're in trouble. You can't earn any money. And so there's immediate problems. Immediate. In other words, we're talking about usury causing immediate problems, social unrest, that would more often than not, throughout this period of time, lead to the expulsion of the Jews from any country. So the standard Jewish explanation is anti-Semitism. It's an awful thing. Every country they go, there's anti-Semitism. It just grows like your beard. You know what I mean? Unless you shave it every day, this anti-Semitism is going to take over. Well, it turns out that the real reason is Jewish behavior. As always, the reason people don't like Jews is because the way Jews behave. And in this instance, it's lending money, which caused huge amounts of animosity. So England expelled the Jews in 1290, and because basically the people rioted. And the people rioted, and the first thing they did was head toward the Jews' house to burn the records about how much money he owed. And the king, realizing it's going to be insurrection, just expels the Jews, reneges on his loans, and that's the story over and over and over again throughout Europe. During this period of time, the Catholic Church starts protesting. Specifically, the Dominicans, the new orders, the mendicant orders, the Dominicans and the Franciscans start preaching against usury. For a century, they're preaching against usury. Okay? The princes don't like this.
This is like, what, 13th?
Well, the beginning of the city would be the 13th century. By the 13th century, you have cities like Paris and all the city-states. By the 15th century, the 1400s, it's intense. This is getting intense. So we're talking about two centuries of preaching against usury. And the princes don't want to hear it because they get good rates from the Jews. This is what St. John Capistran was talking about. He would forever preach against the privileges of the Jews. What's he talking about? Well, the Jew comes in, the prince gets at 5%, and everybody else has to pay 43 1/3%, you know, or something like that. So they're unhappy, and so how are we going to deal with it? Well, the Medici, who were the papal bankers, the big banking family in Florence, take over the city in 1328. Cosimo becomes the whatever it is they call the guy there. It's not a king, it's a republic. First thing he does is bring the Jews in. This is in the aftermath of the first worker rebellion. At the end of the 14th century, the beginning of the money era, the serfs were being cheated out of their labor. They were being ground. They needed money. And so there was rebellions in England. It was Wat Tyler. In Florence, it was called the Ciompi Rebellion. Basically a worker rebellion because they were being cheated. The money was being debased. They were being cheated out of their wages. And they wanted a better, more equitable system. The princes tricked them. The worker rebellions got nowhere. And then when Cosimo took over Florence, he indicated that he was not going to listen to their grievances by the fact that he brought the Jews in once again. They're always being expelled and brought back in. He brings them back in as a sign, we're not going to pay you a decent wage. This is always the infallible sign that you're not being paid a decent wage. Whether it's Florence in the end of the 14th century, whether it's the United States in the 1970s. What happened in America is the same thing that happened then. Wages stopped going up in the 1970s, and as soon as wages stopped going up, guess what arrives on the scene? Credit cards. And so credit cards take up the slack that wages, and they give the people the illusion that they still have money. When you don't, you're being cheated out of your wages, and the credit card is the proof that you're being cheated out of your wages. So this forestalls problems. But anytime you're dealing with usury, any solution for any present solution is always paving the way for a disaster on the horizon. Because of compound interest. You can never keep up. No one can keep up with it. No one on the face of this earth. And so eventually the Medici family goes bust. The people are upset. And there's a revolution that takes place, largely because the King of France shows up. And the Medici leave, and a new dictator comes in. His name is Savonarola. A famous Dominican, and this is a moment. It's one of those moments in history where things could have gone right, because Savonarola has a true sense of what Christian culture is all about, and what it's all about is charity. And the antithesis of charity in this instance is sodomy and usury. These are the twin ills of Florence and the twin ills in the United States right now. The more things change, the more they're the same. Sodomy and usury are the infallible sign that your culture is terminally corrupt.
And that was Dante's, well, in his famous book, The Inferno.
The only one of the few guys who got this right was Dante. When he wrote The Inferno, he put sodomites and usurers in the same circle in hell. Because they're both unnatural. The sodomite takes what is fertile, namely sex, and makes it sterile through homosexual activity. And the usurer takes what is sterile, namely money, and makes it fertile through usury. So they're both bad. And so Savonarola brings about a huge reform of behavior, symbolized by the bonfire of the vanities, where people would throw their, mirrors and Botticelli threw a couple paintings on it and burned them up, and repentance is on the horizon. Problem is, depending on your point of view, the Pope is probably the most corrupt Pope in the history of the Church, Alexander VI, Borgia. And Savonarola doesn't like him, and the feeling is mutual, and Savonarola calls for the King of France to depose the Pope. Bad idea. Okay. Because the Pope is not going to put up with this. And so the Pope connives with the sodomites and the usurers in Florence, and they arrest Savonarola and they put him to death. And at this point, the moment of reform dies. It could have spread throughout all of Christendom, this reform, if the Church had, but we had a corrupt Pope. We had corrupt church officials who were involved themselves in usury, and so it died. And so the next time around, it's not going to be reform, it's going to be reformation. And so Lorenzo's son is now Pope Leo X. 1517, he hears something's going on in Germany. This is when Luther posts his theses in Wittenberg, and he dismisses it as a quarrel among monks. No big deal. And Christendom is destroyed. And once the unity of Christendom is destroyed by the Protestant revolt, the Church loses its police power.
But you're saying that the revolt was, from certain angles, was justified. It was a response to the corruption that was occurring.
Luther was upset about indulgences. You know this. Why is he upset about indulgences? Because, well, how do you pay for an indulgence? Well, it's gold. So the gold is bleeding out of
Germany
down to Rome. So they feel that they're losing their power. The lower nobility, guys like Ulrich von Hutten, are being replaced by people like the Fuggers, who are the merchant class. They're feeling alienated. And so they combine and they create this revolution, which basically is based on plunder. In every Protestant country, it was theft. The motivation for the Reformation was theft. And all of the theology came after the fact to justify the theft. And so the example we know the best is Henry VIII in England, who plundered church property. and then ended up bankrupt anyway. Why did he? How can you plunder all of this wealth, 900 years of accumulated wealth,
but what, and end but up what, one third of what percentage was belonged to the church that he took?
The amount of property in a place like Bohemia, 50% of the property was owned by the church.
Right. So
we're going to talk about something along those lines in every country in Europe, give or take, you know, something like that. Because over 900 years, these monasteries that I mentioned, the Benedictines, had become wealthy. The individuals weren't wealthy, but the collectivity was. And they would, you know, they'd have gold and decorations and so on and so forth. And so the princes at a certain point couldn't resist it, and they stole it. And that's called the Reformation. And the Protestants then came up with a theological justification for it. You name it, but it's all just justification for theft. This isn't my story. The head of the patron saint of the Baptists, the Anabaptist, Thomas Münzer, patron saint of the Charismatics. He had Luther's number. Luther and Münzer hated each other for various reasons, but he had Luther's number. He said, "You're just doing this for the princes," you know. So that's what happened. And so as a result of the church losing its police power, you had certain centers of capitalism now growing up. The church won back pretty much all of Germany during the Counter-Reformation, but they couldn't get Holland. Duke of Alba tried, Duke of Parma tried, couldn't do it. And so what you had was a Calvinist enclave in Amsterdam, which then became the basis for capitalism, allied with England, which became the other basis of capitalism. And so that became, once that's established, then you have a war, a centuries of war, economic warfare over who's going to run the world.
Is that between the Protestants and the Catholics?
Yes, yes, okay. Yes. So the first one would be, it's between Protestants and Protestants. The English fought the Dutch at a certain point too. But the beginning of the first war was England versus Spain. Spain, the Catholic power, and England got rich from plundering these Spanish galleons coming back from the New World. So just to give you, I've said this before, but just to give you some indication of the power of usury as opposed to any power on the face of this earth, when the Habsburgs started borrowing money from the Fuggers, who were the successors of the Medici as papal bankers, they started in 1494, around then. The Fuggers never charged them more than 5%. During the course of the next 70 years, the Fuggers came into, not the Fuggers, the Habsburgs, and basically became the owners of every single gold and silver mine in the New World. And a river of gold and silver started flowing into Spain, and 70 years later, they went bankrupt. Because not even all the gold in America can keep up with compound interest.
What is the, because people never think about it. I don't think people even think about compound interest and usury. People don't use the word usury.
No.
So it's so subtle that people just kind of...
You're not supposed to think about it. Decent people are only supposed to talk about gay marriage and go to football games. They're not supposed to talk about these things. And that's why we have gay marriage and football games, to distract people from their own economic interest and keep them stupid and poor, because that's the Jewish world that we live in right now.
But we are $18 trillion in debt ourselves, which is an impossible debt to recover from. I mean, and people still don't like to think about that.
That's not the significant debt. The significant debt is personal debt. I mean, it has a role to play, but the real significant debt is personal debt.
Each individual person and
family.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what really crushes you. That's what crushes the economy. Because eventually all you're doing is paying off your loans. You let it go long enough, you think, oh, I'll just do the minimum payment. Well, that just starts to snowball. And I'm saying, the example is, if you think you can beat it, well, take a look at what happened to the Habsburgs.
Yeah, but why can't individuals overcome that? Don't they have the moral strength?
No, I'm sure. You have free will, and the answer to your question is, don't borrow money. That's simple. Don't borrow money. But in a capitalist economy, You're forced to borrow money in all sorts of subtle ways. And the worst right now is student debt. These poor kids are being suckered into going $100,000, $200,000 in debt. Just on the idea that they're going to get an education. This is a scandal. This is an outrage. And the fact that Notre Dame calls itself a Catholic college, has an $11 billion dollar endowment, and still raises the price every year on the students is a scandal. This cries to heaven for vengeance. The fact that these people now, if they go to Notre Dame, are going to end up $240,000 in debt. You're not going to get out. I'm sorry. We're living in a deflationary economy right now. I got a catalog, clothing catalog, comes in the mail. I'm looking at these prices are crazy. It's cheap junk. It's from China. It's not, this is wool, okay? That cheap junk, you can get a sweater for $14? Are you kidding me? That's a deflationary economy, which means that you've got a debt at premium numbers and you're paying it back on little deflated dollars. The best example of that is how many people are underwater now with their houses? This shows you the injustice of this thing. You bought a house for $100,000 on a 30-year mortgage and you've been paying money and you're 15 years into it. You've already paid twice the amount you borrowed and now your house is only worth $50,000. This is outrageous. If the people weren't watching their damn football games and talking about gay marriage, they'd be out in the streets, which is why we have football games and television. In the Middle Ages, they knew what was going on. They started marching to where the Jew was living and burned his house down and burned his records, and they were out of debt. That's the way you cancel debt in the Middle Ages.
But is this like, I mean, you're going to be going to India in January, and you wrote the article about the rape crisis, and all of a sudden they're showing risque movies, and the Indian girls are not dressing modestly anymore, and the men can't control themselves.
Yes.
Is there a connection between men's lusts, they can't control themselves, and the lust for money?
Yes, of course there is. The India, up until the fall of the Soviet Union, India was an ally of the Soviet Union, was basically a socialist country. When the Soviet Union failed, they lost their nerve and they turned to the IMF for loans and became part of the capitalist New World Order. IMF says, okay, we'll give you the loans, but you have to change your culture, and that means we have to privatize your communication industry, let the big guys in. And so as a result, the first thing they get is this sexual imagery starts flooding in. This is important to capitalism. It's not coincidence. These things go hand in hand. The first step in capitalism is sexual corruption, because the people are so befuddled. Their minds are clouded. They can't understand what's going on. And what you're doing is creating a consumer. A consumer is a guy who acts on his passions. He buys on impulse. They like that. Why do you think the homosexual is the ideal citizen in the United States? Because he's a slave of his passions. Because he's narcissistic. Because he has disposable income. Because he acts on impulse. Because he's driven by passion and not reason. This is the world that capitalism wants to create. This is what they're creating in India right now. And the fact of the matter is, every monster, every time they do it, it gets out of control.
Right, so America is going to become a Frankenstein.
No, America isn't. The Indians are going to become Frankenstein. These guys are going, just the other day. First of all, just yesterday, the cab driver in Uttar Pradesh, for Uber cab, okay, drives the lady, picks up a business lady, you can just from a business deal, drives her to a secluded spot and rapes her. More outrage. Rape is epidemic now in India. Why is he doing that? Why is that happening now? Well, the day before that, they have the new Muslim chick, the reality TV star, the Muslim chick who's supposed to be the model for the Muslim girls in India. She's dancing, she's shaking her booty on a reality TV show with a live audience. Okay, so a Muslim guy in the audience walks up to her and smacks her in the face. And as he's dragged away, they're going to charge him with assault. He said, "Mini skirts destroy men's brains." Well, he's right. He's right. Nobody's going to admit it, but that's true. And that's what's going on in India right now. Because we need a totally sexually besotted, the capitalists need a sexually besotted culture before they can really exploit it.
Before the interview, I was thinking of your three books, Libido Dominante, The Spirit of the Revolutionary Jew, and Capitalism. There is a connection between those themes.
Yes.
In other words, if you can get people into immoral sex, it's going to cloud their brain, and they can't make good decisions regarding money.
No, that's right.
Is there a connection?
Of course there is. Okay. Of course there is. And now it's a system. So what happened? Why do you think the sexual revolution of the 1960s was followed by the introduction of the credit card? Well, it's not just because wages are going down. It's because people are trained to be impulsive buyers. And how do you train somebody to be impulsive? Well, you get him involved in pornography and sexual activity.
Right, so his brain is seeking after this.
Yeah, so that Muslim guy is right. The miniskirts destroy your brain. Proof of that is America. What happened to America after the 1960s? So that's what's going on in India. That's what's going on around the world. Now, the place where it is not happening is Iran, because they understood in 1979 that what was going on in an inchoate way. The Ayatollah Khomeini had some insight into the fact that the Shah was doing this to the Iranian population. They created a revolution to overthrow the American puppet, the Shah, and they created an Islamic state in its place. And America has never forgiven them, because it is a standing affront that one nation in this world is going to act according to different principles. That's not the way it works. We are the most messianic, religiously driven people on the face of the earth, the United States of America, and the religion is mammon. It is the worship of money. It's exactly what Karl Marx said. Exactly.
But we want to say we're Christian at the same time, which is...
That's the best way to convince somebody to take you seriously, to convert to mammon. Sure, we're Christian. What are Presbyterians? This isn't a joke. What's a Methodist? It's a Baptist who can read. What's a Presbyterian? A Presbyterian is a missionary for capitalism. It began with the battle between the Lowland Scots, like Adam Smith and David Hume, against the Highland Scots during the Jacobite rebellions of the 18th century. And finally, with the final Jacobite rebellion of 1745, when that was crushed, the Presbyterians could then project capitalism, Whiggery, the English language, on the rest of the world, which is precisely what they did. They showed up in America and they started to evangelize the natives.
The British called the American Revolution the Presbyterian Revolt, but Scottish Rite Freemasonry, Masonry and Presbyterian, there seemed to be a connection.
Yes. Yes. And I deal with the whole Masonic thing in the Jewish revolutionary spirit and where that came from. And that's you're right. That's part of the story. You're absolutely right. That's part of the story.
But then capitalism, the flip side, fits into that, right? I mean,
Presbyterianism is exoteric capitalism. That's what it's capitalism for the masses. That's what it is. It's basically, you want to call it the Protestant ethic, whatever you want to call it, but basically it's a mobilization of religion in the service of mammon.
Well, directly, the Republican Party had a strong foundation in the Feuerites, right? And the Feuerites said that you achieve happiness by accumulating wealth.
It's not a new idea. That's the gospel of prosperity. That's what America is. If there's a state religion, it is the religion of mammon, the religion of prosperity. And that religion is now being forced on the rest of the world. And that's why they're annoyed at Iran, because Iran said no thanks. And India is now in a situation where they're helpless in understanding what's going on. So I'm hoping to bring some type of understanding to the people there when I go. Like explaining, what is the real cause of the rape crisis? Well, it's capitalism. It's capitalism. But so we have a battle.
But you define, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you did define it, capitalism in there as I was just scanning it. You said it was Jewish business practices?
Or? No, that's not what I said. It's state-sponsored usury.
Okay.
Capitalism is state-sponsored usury. And that's what it was in the United States. The creditor class created the United States in their interest. And they made laws. In a Catholic country, you cannot collect usurious debts because it's criminal. You can't enforce criminal behavior. And so this is the purpose, the new world of capitalism, which is basically now the state is going to insist that you pay off usurious debts. You know, and that's what capitalism is. So the creditors create the United States to their advantage, and it causes problems. 70 years, you got unrepayable debt, and then it leads to massive war as the way out of unrepayable debt, and so on and so forth. So you have this struggle. England conquers Spain. England defeats France. And then in the 19th century, it's England versus Germany. By the end of the 19th century, it's England versus Germany. Because Germany is the heir of the Holy Roman Empire, which was what the Benedictines created after the fall of Rome. And it's the only place on earth that still values labor. There was an article about Amazon and how terrible Amazon is to its employees in England and the United States, but it's not that bad in, guess where? Germany. Because they still stand up for workers' rights there in a way that they do not do in English-speaking countries. So that leads to, eventually the Germans are defeated. During this period of time, Germany had to come into existence as a country. It was a bunch of principalities that had been conquered by Napoleon, caused a lot of soul-searching, and eventually Germany. The reason I'm here, and the reason at least half of me is here, and the reason half of you is here, is because the Germans did not provide decent... They were crushed by Napoleon, and they weren't providing any opportunity for wages, earning a decent wage. Bishop von Kettler noticed this. He proposed reform. Bishop von Kettler is the founder of Catholic social teaching. He said the family is the unit of society. The criterion of a just wage is not how far down you can drive it. It's not a commodity like any other commodity that's a function of supply and demand. It is a function of the family. And so the criterion of a just wage is whether a man by himself can support a wife and children on his salary. That is the objective criterion. If that's not it, your society is not just. Well, guess what happened during this period of time? Just as we're talking about the 70s, what was the big dance craze in the 70s other than disco? It was called feminism. And what is the main tenet of feminism other than making a sacrament out of abortion? It is equal pay for equal work, which is code word for destroy the family wage.
Well, because and the scripture says the woman is to be a keeper at home.
That's right.
So
what happened in Florence when they did this? The workers died out. There were no workers. They couldn't reproduce. Well, you're destroying the workforce if you do that. You got a one generation deal, and the only way America is dealing with it is by bringing in Mexicans and all these other people. Becomes a magnet for every form of cheap labor in the world.
Just in the South Bend Tribune, I think that we're at the lowest birth rate ever right now.
Yeah. So that's what it's about. It's time for us all to look. Turn off your Notre Dame football game. They're going to lose anyway. Turn off your pornography. Don't talk about gay marriage. Talk about something real. Talk about the fact that as a student, you're involved in crushing debt, and it's not right. Talk about the fact that you're underwater. You bought this house, and now you're underwater, and you got to pay $250,000 for a $50,000 house because you took out $100,000 mortgage. Let's talk about reality now, and stop talking about the bread and circuses here, all of which are there, whether it's sex, whether it's pornography, or whether it's football, to distract us from the real issues.
If the father in the home was doing a good job, wouldn't he be protecting his children and his wife from these things?
What do you think pornography is there to do? First of all, to get the father involved in illicit sexual activity, or to get people involved so that they can't form families because these slave drivers love rootless individuals because they're easier to manipulate. That's why the homosexual is the ideal citizen. Don't form a family. Just live by yourself, with your iPad or whatever it's called now. You know what I mean? Off in your isolated little room, and think how liberated you are.
Right, but it's ideal for the interest of the 2%. It's not ideal for the interest of the 98%.
That's right. Absolutely.
So I
was at Occupy Wall Street. I begin this book with a discussion of Occupy Wall Street, and that's a manifestation of the fact that people are unhappy. The young people who were there in their 20s have crushing student debt and also no prospect of getting a job. That's a revolutionary situation. And so they had to be clubbed. That's what happened to them. The cops came in and clubbed them. You know, we'll tolerate this for a little bit, but when push comes to shove, Lloyd Blankfein calls up and the cops club the demonstrators.
If a father, you know, they in the old days, they would encourage you to go to college. Well, nobody came out with a debt.
That's right.
So that encouragement was harmless. I mean, it wasn't very much negative. But now the fathers, the head of the home, is encouraging their children to go to school.
If the Notre Dame University was created by the Holy Cross priest as an act of charity, educating people was an act of charity. Same reason the Holy Cross nuns created the hospital. What we've seen in our lifetime is the change from a charity to an absolutely rapacious usurer, sucking the blood out of Catholic youth and condemning them. This is Notre Dame. It's a sin that cries to heaven for vengeance. That's what usury is. And well, that's what they're participating in.
If you would have had the groups in the 60s, and there was a lot of groups in the 60s trying to figure out what was going on, and if you would have told them, even the groups at Notre Dame in the late 60s, early 70s, that their children would be paying what they're paying to go to Notre Dame, they would have pulled their hair out. I mean,
That's why I'm going to India. I can go back from the future to the present. I'm like the guy who came from the future. I'm like Lincoln Steffens. I've been to the future and it doesn't work. This is your future now. Maybe they'll listen. I don't know. We'll talk about it when I get back.
Okay, so we only have a minute or so left. That's the book.
Baron Metal, go to culturewars.com and begin your liberation from the debt society, the debt slavery that the society is creating for you. Culturewars.com.
Okay, and then you'll be going to India to address the rape crisis, and we will continue to see if you're free to come on and share the wisdom the Lord's given you, and hopefully people that are watching this will continue their pursuit of knowing the truth. And Jesus said, He is the truth, and He said, the words that I speak are the truth.